I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from soggy Boston. Do you have a loved one running today's marathon? Can they swim? We'll have an update later. But we start with a look at the week ahead, which in Washington begins with Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz trying to hold on to their jobs. And some fighting words from President Bush on war funding. This morning, the president accused Democrats of trying to, in his words, legislate defeat in Iraq by passing war funding bills that include timelines for troop withdrawals.
One of the lessons of September the 11th is what happens overseas matters to the security of the United States of America. And we must not forget that lesson. The consequences of a failure in Iraq would be death and destruction in the Middle East and here in America.
Joining us on the line, John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. John, help us get ready for the week ahead. Let's start with the president. He said he'll veto any measure that includes withdrawal timelines. And over the weekend, Vice President Cheney said he's willing to bet that the Democrats, you know, who lead Congress, will back down on timelines. First of all, how much are you willing to bet on that?
I'd bet a lot on it. I think Cheney is right that the Democrats are not wanting right now to have a major confrontation with Bush over the timelines. What I'd expect to happen would be Pelosi and Reid will meet with Bush at the White House this week. No one expects a breakthrough to come from that meeting. The House and Senate will reconcile their two bills, send them to Bush. He'll veto them. And then fairly soon after that, I would expect that the Democratic Congress will pass a more or less clean bill with some benchmarks for Iraqis to meet and try to shape their legislation toward the end of the summer, which is when David Petraeus, the guy leading the surge efforts in Iraq, has said that the surge would try to work. If it's plainly not working at that point, that's when I think you'd see Democrats try to confront the president.
We should say that Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin has said that if Bush vetoes the bill as expected, Democrats will probably try to come back with new legislation that at least has the benchmarks, if not the timetable for withdrawal. I'm just wondering, John, in listening to what the president just said today, once again, bringing up 9/11 as related to Iraq, one thought that that was a thing of the past.
Look, that is what the president thinks this is all about. He believes that himself. That is not that the war itself was against the perpetrators of 9/11, mm-hmm. but rather in the broader sense that we have to confront terrorists abroad, or they're going to come here. Democrats, of course, say that what the president's policy is doing is creating more terrorists. That's not an argument that's going to be settled. The president's on the short side of it in terms of public opinion. He's lost ground. But that's what he believes. His strongest card really is going to be the support the troops card, and they've been playing that as well.
Okay, let's move on to Alberto Gonzalez. He faces a Senate judiciary hearing tomorrow over the weekend. The attorney general released the transcript of what he's going to tell senators tomorrow about the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys last year. He will apologize for how the firings were handled, say his memory's hazy, but insist again that nothing improper was done. Now, some, like Republican Lindsey Graham, are saying that Gonzalez will hold on to his job. What are you hearing?
I hear Republicans privately being pretty pessimistic about the situation and essentially having the attorney general on his own to go before the Senate committee and try to save his job. But when you make a judgment on the basis of the skill and competence he's displayed so far, it doesn't make you optimistic about his ability. And he certainly didn't help himself, Robin, with the op-ed he released over the weekend where he starts out the piece saying, I made the decision to remove some U.S. attorneys, but do it privately. I regret that it blew up into a big issue. Later on in the same piece, he says, to my knowledge, I didn't make the decision to remove any particular attorneys. Hmm. What does that say about someone managing the Justice Department if they didn't make the decision about such a major initiative?
Right. Well, in the minute we have, on to Paul Wolfowitz, architect of the Iraq War when he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, now head of the World Bank, accused of influence peddling on behalf of his girlfriend who also works at the bank. He got her a job promotion with higher pay. Now, he says in his defense, he asked others to move her out so they weren't working together, which would be inappropriate, and no one did, so he did. The Financial Times reports today that European countries are not sufficiently united to force him out. What are you reading?
You know, I think Paul Wolfowitz has given his critics about as good an issue to use against him as they could have dreamed up. This is a guy who's made the fight against corruption a centerpiece of his tenure at the World Bank, and now to have an issue that at least suggests the possibility of personal corruption, that is helping your someone that you're in a personal relationship with, is a prime target. Could he save his job? Certainly it's possible, but he's put himself in a bad spot.
John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC and columnist for The Wall Street Journal, helping us get ready for the week ahead in Washington. John, thanks so much.
Stay dry.
A new ABC News Washington Post poll shows that 51% of Americans think Don Imus should have lost his job over his racially insensitive remarks, but 45% say he should have kept it. And within that result, a racial divide. 73% of black Americans supported the firing. Only 47% of whites did. Perhaps because the phrase I misused, nappy-headed, is for many African Americans, the other N-word, an historically derogatory term that, according to researchers, including our next guest, became the proof that social inequities like racism, even slavery, were justified. In a couple of minutes, we're going to get the view from the hair salon. But first, Zini Magubane is an associate professor of sociology at Boston College, and she joins us now. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
And let's get a definition here. Give us the standard definition of nappy hair.
Well, the standard definition is to describe hair that is generally tightly coiled or spiraled and short or shorter.
Well, we've spoken on this program about how the founders of this country justified waging their own fight for independence while they owned slaves. And you say that hair actually factored into that process? How?
Well, given the fact that racial intermixture was as much a part of slavery as rigid denunciations of it, human phenotypes very quickly varied a great deal. So people seeking to establish the fact that actually these boundaries were rigid, were unchanging, fixated on various body parts, skin color being one of them, but hair was also seized upon as being sort of a immutable standard or a fixed racial essence by which you could judge, is a person black, is a person white.
And therefore, by being black, are they, you know, worthy of full status as a human being?
Exactly.
And you write that in Notes on the State of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson writes about this, you know, how can I justify not incorporating blacks, you know, into the body politic? And he wrote about hair. What did he say?
Yes, he did. I mean, he was trying to think through, could blacks be incorporated into the body politic? He ultimately concludes no. And he concludes it's because of, he says, differences both physical and moral. And then he goes on to enumerate those differences. He talks about skin, but he also talks about hair as one example of the fundamental physical differences. And he even goes on in the Notes in the State of Virginia to say that not only was hair, particularly of a black woman, a marker of her inferiority, it was also something that made her so unattractive that he himself says that an orangutan would prefer her over the company of a female orangutan.
And by the way, remind us, Thomas Jefferson, we find later.
Well, then also was having a relationship, in quotes, with the slave, right, Sally Hemings.
Did he also write that not having long flowing hair, I mean, did
yes.
he actually say that?
Yes, he says. I mean, he talks about, you know, the darkness of the skin, and he talks about the absence of physical beauty. He talks about how can we consider them human when they look this way, and he mentions that the lack of, in his words, long flowing hair is indicative not only of the fundamental unattractiveness of this group of people, but also their questionable humanity.
I mean, this is a charged, charged word.
Extremely.
You give another example, a South African bushwoman who was exhibited, you know, like a circus freak in London in the early 1800s. And her short, curling hair was proof of what to some researchers at the time?
Well, Sarji Bartman, the woman that I spoke of, was, you know, exhibited in the shows of London in the early 1800s. And she was exhibited for what people felt at the time were the abnormalities of her physical person. So you can't really separate out the fact that they talked about what they called her enormous behind. They talked about her supposed genital abnormalities, and they also talked about her unattractive physical features and this short curling hair. Others called it woolly hair. Peppercorn hair was another derogatory term. All of that went together to construct her as an inferior being and representative of black women, black people, and their subhuman status.
Right. Perhaps the missing link between humans and apes.
Exactly.
Then you write, during slave times, there'd been miscegenation at this point, and so people had varying skin tones and varying kinds of hair at this point. Mm-hmm. What did slaves do with their hair when, for instance, they were trying to run away?
Many slaves shaved their heads to either disguise their racial ancestry, to disguise their appearance, because the posters that slave owners posted with the descriptions, hair was an extremely important identifying trait. They would list the height of the person, the weight of the person, their skin tone, and their hair was central to identifying them. And also there was the notion that if a person was light enough to pass for white, oftentimes their hair might have a more typical African appearance. So slave catchers warned, be on the lookout for these runaways with light skin who might have shaved their heads so they might pass for white.
Right. So it's no surprise that, you know, maybe 100 years later we found African-American women in this country taking desperate, you know, means to straighten their hair. I mean, was this sort of, maybe no longer spoken of, but somehow just in the ether that you have to do something about your hair?
Yeah, I mean, black women's relationship to their hair is complicated.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be surprised that people so stigmatized sought to rid themselves of a stigma. Right? Yeah. So straightening the hair became one way to rid oneself of the stigma. But of course, for other people, it's just artifice and fashion. I mean, people's attitudes towards their hair are complicated.
In all races. But particularly here, again, because of this such a charged past. And others have pointed out, Madam C.J. Walker, the first black woman to become a millionaire, made her fortune on hair products used to straighten hair. It's
yes.
No real surprise that she did that. But then there was a time, I'm thinking the 60s, when people were wearing their hair naturally with pride. I mean, the pendulum seems to have swung quite a bit.
Yes. I mean, during the 60s, certainly the part of the political movement to reclaim black humanity was to destigmatize the black phenotype. So it's not surprising that the whole notion of black is beautiful would encompass embracing Afro hairstyles, embracing braids, embracing more traditional African hairstyles, because for such a long time it had been so critical to the discourse to say that this was something unattractive, this was something that you should be moving away from, and this is something that marked you as, again, less than human.
That's Zini Magubane. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at Boston College. Our conversation today, the historical origins of the phrase nappy-headed for African Americans. When we come back, we'll have more with Zini. We'll move forward in history to the political, the move in the 60s to embrace one's natural nappy hair, and the personal, how to treat it. Zini herself has described her own hair as short dreadlocks. Her mom had straight hair and didn't know what to do with her daughter's hair. One of the issues that arises. We'll have more with Zini. And also, don't forget, later in the program, a report from the Soggy Boston Marathon. Back after a quick break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Zini Magubane. She's an associate professor of sociology at Boston College, and she's speaking to us about the loaded history of the phrase nappy hair. It's recent history as well. In 1998, a white teacher brought the book Nappy Hair into PS 75 in Brooklyn, and some parents of African-American kids were livid, even though the book affirmed natural hair. So, Zini, we can tell when the phrase is used derogatorily. But do you think that nappy can be used fondly in an embrace of natural hair?
Sure, that's a really interesting question. I mean, what we're seeing is an attempt to reclaim the term. Because for children, it is one of the first areas where you're marked out as different. And starting about in the 1960s, black psychologists began to take this issue very, very seriously and to talk to parents, first of all, about their own internalized racism and the types of comments that might come from an older relative, a grandparent.
These are black parents.
Yes. Mm-hmm. About, the child has good hair versus meaning it's straighter versus, bad hair.
And these were internalized during the history
we
were just talking about.
Exactly. So there has been a strong internal critique within the black community and a strong attempt to if not rehabilitate the word, at least rehabilitate people's feelings about different textures of hair.
Well, a little full disclosure. I speak as a white woman with four black children in different branches of the family, all mm-hmm. young. Now, hair is painful for a lot of kids when mom brushes it too mm-hmm. hard, pulls it too tight in a ponytail, whether you're whatever color on the spectrum you are. I'm wondering if that sort of adds to some of the weight of this issue, that sometimes it's just plain painful.
The pain of it, interestingly enough, doesn't come from the texture of the hair itself, but rather from the fact that, like, if you go into a typical CVS, there are not the products, the combs, etc., readily available to take care of the hair. So, for example, if you look at travelers' narratives from the 1700s, 1800s, they talk about seeing African people with beautifully adorned hair. They had the implements, the tools, the cultural knowledge, how to work well with the hair. And indeed, part of breaking slave culture was to not allow people to engage in traditional hairstyling practices.
As I said, this can be a tension between any mother and a mm-hmm. daughter.
Yes.
And that there is perhaps an additional tension at times between black mothers and daughters when it is physically painful, mm-hmm. Trying to work with the hair.
You can't really go to like a supercuts. Mm. So the tension arises from perhaps the daughter's desire simply to fit in. Mm. And the mother will have her own complicated relationship to it, whether she might think straightening hair is some sort of a denial of blackness, right, depending upon her particular history, or if she feels like, hair should be straightened. So it's less the problem in the texture of the hair than the social institutions that aren't there to support it.
Zini Magubane, Associate Professor of Sociology at Boston College. To read more of her writing, go to our website, here-now.org. Professor Magubane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as Professor Magubane says, she and other blacks feel they can't really go to Supercuts, but she can go, for instance, to Davies in the Boston neighborhood of Roxbury. And that's where Here Now's Philip Martin went to get the last word on hair.
My name is Sonia Cherry.
Have you had customers who refer to their own hair as nappy in your view?
Most African Americans refer to their hair as nappy. I have had clients who say, my hair is so nappy, what can you do with it? And because I'm African American, I understand as a hairstylist, I don't consider the hair to be nappy. I consider the hair to be super curly or even kinky. And to me, beautiful and easy to work with. When one African-American says it to another African-American, it's not taken as harshly as when somebody outside of the African-American culture says nappy head. So when you come into a salon to enhance your looks or to enhance your beauty, that's what it is. You want to beautify. So do something with my quote-unquote nappy hair is beautify me. Make me pretty. And you can do that and maintain your original hair texture. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with kinky hair, super curly hair, black hair.
Give me an idea of the process that you would go through to quote unquote beautify someone who comes in complaining, if you will, about their nappy hair.
Relaxer, a pressing comb, a straightener, Most African-American women, and I hate to say this, but it's there's some truth to it, the self-image and the poor self-image. So they would prefer a straightener so that they can look more European. So because of that, then we have to do the relaxer system, which is going to straighten the hair, or a temporary straightener such as the pressing comb or the blow dryer or both in combination. I personally wear my hair natural. There are no chemicals in my hair. I have color in my hair, but there are no straightening chemicals in my hair because I think that the super curly, kinky, wavy hair is beautiful.
That's Sonia Cherry of Davies. From there, I went to King's and Queen's Beauty Salon, where a woman named Queen was holding court.
What's the most popular hairstyle right now?
Right now? I guess you can say weave. A lot of women wear weave for convenience or for versatility, not because they have nappy hair. I guess you can say that.
And your hair is quite beautiful. What can you describe the style of hair you have that our audiences might be able to understand?
Well, it's just the traditional, or I guess you can say, old-time finger waves. So it's just a full head of flat finger waves. So throughout my hair, there's a pattern of waves going throughout.
And the young lady whose hair you're working in right now, her hair is absolutely beautiful as well.
She's getting her hair flat ironed. So she has, her hair isn't relaxed at the moment. It's just blow-dried out and flat ironed with the flat iron curler here. A lot of the styles that African-American women or ethnic women do now, the European or Caucasian women are also doing what we do. So they are also crossing over, trying to get kinkier hair, or if they use flat irons and stuff, you know, so hair is hair.
That's Queen of Kings and Queens Beauty Salon here in Boston, talking with Here Now's Philip Martin. Well, still ahead, the French elections, the Boston Marathon, and more here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The campaign for president in France is heading into the home stretch. Voters go to the polls next Sunday, and the top two finishers will then face off in the final round next month. Alessandra Galloni reports on France for the Wall Street Journal from Paris. Alessandra, how is this election resonating there? How high volume has it been?
Very high volume for several reasons. First off is you have a number of young candidates, in particularly the two front runners, who are 52 for Mr. Nicolas Sarkozy, the former interior minister, and 54 for Madame Ségolène Royal, who is the socialist candidate. Mm-hmm. And this in France is very young for a presidential race.
And we understand that this election has galvanized poor neighborhoods. There's a 60% turnout expected. So put this in context for us. The New York Times Sunday Magazine this past weekend said you can't understand the French elections of 2007 without understanding what happened in France in 2005. And these were the full-scale riots after two young men were chased by police and accidentally died. So give us a little bit of the impetus behind this election.
The protests in November 2005 brought to the fore an issue that has been simmering in France for a long time, and that is how to integrate the increasingly mostly Muslim immigrant population in France, who now many of them live in what is called the banlieue, these impoverished suburbs on the fringes of cities like Paris and Marseille. And during the protests in November 2005, their anger at not having equal job opportunities, at not having adequate housing, all of this really came to the fore. So now this is still very vivid in people's minds as the elections draw near. In particular, this memory has been resuscitated, if you will, over some recent clashes at Paris's Gare du Nord station, in which mostly immigrant youths, again, clashed with police. And so the whole issue of immigration and security has once again come to the forefront of the campaign.
Well, remind us who the three main contenders are. You just mentioned two. Let's mention their names again and where they stand on these issues. Let's start with Nicolas Sarkozy.
Nicolas Sarkozy is France's former interior minister. He recently resigned in order to dedicate full time to the campaign. And he is the hardliner. He's sort of the tough on crime, tough on immigration person. A year ago, he passed a law whereby many illegal immigrants were and continue to be deported. Then you have Ségolène Royal, who is at the moment, according to the polls, in second place. She is the socialist candidate. She has a softer approach. It's not exactly clear what her policies would be, but she basically focuses more on social issues. So she says we need to integrate these immigrants more via better schooling and via help to get them work permits and work contracts.
And we should say she has a shot at being the first female president of France and has appealed directly to women.
Absolutely. She is the first real woman presidential hopeful ever in France. Mm-hmm. There have been others who have run, but she has a real chance. And she has led a campaign that has been very earthy, very on the ground, you know, getting people to participate in debates, town hall meetings, which is something that is quite new for France. And this has appealed to much of the population, and not only women, although she clearly, you know, would mean a lot for this country if she were the first woman president.
And then we have the center's candidate, François Bayrou. Tell us more about him.
He is sort of the third man, and he has run before for president, but this time pollsters say he has a real shot. He's currently third in the polls, and he's appealing to the center. He says, I will take the best from the right, i.e. from Nicolas Sarkozy, and the best from the left, and come up with something in the middle that everybody's happy with. The problem is that we don't quite know what that is.
Well, you mentioned Sarkozy with his hardline stance on immigration, and we're wondering if this is seen as some kind of vindication for the fellow who's fourth in the polls, Jean-Marie Le Pen. This is the right-wing leader who stunned everyone by making it into the second round in the last presidential election, mainly on his hard stance on immigration issues and French identity. Now he says Sarkozy is poaching his issues. But is it seen as some vindication that these are the main issues and mainstream politicians are addressing them, and Jean-Marie Le Pen did for so long?
Absolutely. In this election, Le Pen has about 16% of the vote, according to the polls. And what analysts say, the reason for that is that Mr. Sarkozy has been poaching votes for him because he's been addressing many of the same issues, i.e. immigration, security, that Le Pen campaigned on in 2002.
Has this election sort of redrawn the lines between left and right? Have the sides shifted somewhat to accommodate the public mood?
I would actually say it's the opposite. I think that there is a blurring of the lines, that especially in the beginning of the campaign, both of the candidates tended to come towards the center in order to grab as much of the popular vote as possible. Now, as the campaign draws to an end, they are sort of radicalizing themselves a little bit more, Ségolène Royal trying to appeal to more of her lefty constituency, and Sarkozy trying to appeal more to the Le Pen voters. In fact, just this last weekend, a couple of ministers or former ministers on the socialist side suggested that Ms. Royal team up with Bayrou, the centrist candidate. And Ms. Royal immediately said no, because she wants to get all the people on the left side making sure that they'll vote for her.
The two front runners, what's seen as their Achilles heel? We know that Sarkozy is constantly being reminded of a word he used in 2005 to describe delinquents, and this was just before those riots broke out. He, as interior minister, he described them as scum. That's come back to haunt him. We know that Royale has made a few gaffes of her own. So what's seen as their weaknesses?
That's exactly it. For Nicolas Sarkozy, he is seen as a polarizing, a divisive figure. And that is his biggest Achilles heel. People are afraid that he's too nervous, too angry, too powerful. For Ségolène Royal, on the other hand, the Achilles heel is seen as foreign policy because of her gaffes. She went on a trip to China last year, or early this year, rather, and she said that France could learn something from the Chinese justice system, which, of course, was seen...
Didn't go over very well.
Another gaffe was she suggested that she was pro-sovereignty for Quebec, which also didn't go down very well with the Canadian government.
How much is foreign policy or attitudes towards the U.S., perhaps, and the war in Iraq, a part of this election for French voters?
To be honest, foreign policy is not playing a large role. I think most people believe that pretty much French foreign policy will stay the same. In the beginning, it seemed like Nicolas Sarkozy was more pro-U.S. than the other candidates, and that's probably true, but whether that will translate into a drastically different foreign policy remains to be seen, and perhaps will never happen.
Alessandra Galani, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Paris about the first round of that country's presidential elections, which take place this coming Sunday. Alessandra, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come before we go, the winners are in the Boston Marathon, and the cold weather didn't deter at least one Kenyan. Also, what it's like to ride on the bus that picks up the stragglers. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. Well, it's about time we heard some of your thoughts, and it seems all of you wrote after our conversation with John McCardle, former president of Middlebury College, and now head of the group Choose Responsibility, which advocates lowering the legal drinking age from 21 to 18 and actually licensing kids to drink. Vivian Rockwell agrees. She writes, "In Oregon, my family can't go out together to a club to listen to live music, which we love, because liquor is served and minors aren't permitted to even enter. My sons are 18 and 20. And Thomas McEwen of Massachusetts remembers fondly his neighborhood bar.
I could go in there with my father and have a glass of beer with him and chat with him. And when I went in there were adults, men there who would tend to stabilize things. And the worst thing that we'd want to do is make a fool out of ourselves by getting drunk."
But on the other hand, Helena from Powell, Wyoming, sent us the American Medical Association research that found that the brain goes through important growth during adolescence, which alcohol can seriously shortchange. She writes, "Instead of lowering the drinking age, we should raise the driving and military recruiting age. Those under 21 may not be making the best decisions." And we'll give Kurt Kruger of Lake Norman, North Carolina, the final word on this. "Sure, I work for an insurance company," he writes, "but on the personal level, I say it's crazy to lower the drinking age. You need to look at my name. My cousin, Scott Kruger, died of alcohol poisoning at MIT years ago. Take control and take care of your life." Well, on to young people and the military. We spoke last week with retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich, a professor at Boston University, who opposes troops speaking out for or against the war. He says it's a dangerous road. Well, that brought this call from Wayne Smith, a former combat medic in Vietnam.
"When soldiers join, we do not relinquish all of our rights under the Constitution. In fact, just the opposite. We swear to defend and uphold the Constitution. For those who are carrying the disproportionate burden of this war, not to have their right to petition Congress is undemocratic."
Well, another story about troops moved many of you to tears. Remember we spoke with John Holly, whose son was killed in Iraq, in telling us how he got the military to change its policy and bring the remains of troops home aboard private jets instead of on commercial flights. John broke down when he got to the part of his own son's homecoming. Well, so did Tabitha Renegar from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She writes, "I stayed in my van in order to hear the entire story and be able to clean my face before going back to my office. I'm in awe of the strength demonstrated by Mr. Holly. I'm sick and tired of parents losing their children and vice versa. I hope I can learn from him how to use my anguish more positively. It's the least I can do to honor his son and the many, many other fallen heroes." Well, of course, last week ended with the firing of Don Imus after the uproar over his racially insensitive remarks. Jane Ellen France of Princeton, New Jersey writes, "Might it not have been better for CBS and MSNBC to allow Don Imus to stay, but with clear mandates for programming? I'm not a listener, but he seems to have an audience that might have benefited from some educational program forums." And Jennifer Paris of Knoxville, Tennessee adds, "Let's get this straight. Even though I believe Imus's comments were distasteful, the outcome of this controversy is by definition racist. This would not have been an issue if a black person had made those comments." Well, global warming was in the headlines as well last week. Many of you appreciated our look at Time Magazine's 51 recommendations for curbing your own carbon footprint. James from Boston did not. He writes, "We schnooks are expected to reorder our lives to save a molecule of CO2. Meanwhile, the amount of CO2 expelled by China is excelled only by that used to craft Donald Trump's hair. If the chairman of Time ditches the private jet, I agree to use those crappy, expensive fluorescent light bulbs. I will not have industry's crimes against nature shifted to me in the form of cold showers, treehouse homes, or anything else. Note to self, save a tree. Skip Time Magazine." And finally, after our take on the TV show American Idol, which determined viewers seemed to be hijacking from the producers through their online voting, Jane LaFountain of Fort Bragg, California, weighed in with this opinion. "How ironic. American Idol is the only democratic institution in America. So, the only one we haven't heard from, it seems, is you. Send your emails to letters@here-now.org or call 617-358-0397. Just ahead, how's that soggy Boston Marathon doing here and now? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Patriots Day here in Massachusetts, an official holiday celebrating the battles of Lexington and Concord, but also the 111th running of the Boston Marathon, this year complete with a nor'easter. More than 20,000 people are in the race. Our marathon man, Alex Ashluck, is on the course. And Alex, who won?
Robin, Kenya's Robert Chariot won the men's race for the second straight year. He set a course record here last year, 2 hours, 7 minutes. Today, his time was nearly 7 minutes slower than last year, so the weather definitely had an impact on his race today.
What about the women's race?
A Russian won the race today. Her name is Lydia Goryeva from Russia. Her time was 2:29. That's 9 minutes slower than the course record for women. She said she's been training in weather like this back in Russia, so she was used to it.
Well, and how about the wheelchair race? Because, you know, we always worry about the roads. In that case.
Yeah, it was definitely a problem for them. South African Ernst Van Dijk, he's won this race 6 straight times. He had problems with the weather. He hit a pothole. Japanese wheelchair racers won both the men's and women's races. Masazumi Sojima won the men's race, and Wakako Toshida won the women's race.
Okay, Alex, we're going to hear much more from you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Alex Ashluck from the Boston Marathon. Well, Alex also recently spoke to Catherine Switzer, the first woman to officially run the race with a bib number in 1967. Now, she was tackled by an angry race official named Jock Semple because women weren't allowed to run. She'd signed her entry form KV Switzer and was all bundled up, so race officials didn't realize she was a she. The famous photo of that tackle flashed around the world, and Switzer became a pioneer in women's running. Well, she reflected on that day that changed her life and others with Alex.
I was a college kid who really just wanted to come and run that first great race. And I'd been trained by a little mailman at Syracuse University who had run 15 Boston marathons. And he had told me about every one of them night after night after night in training. And so I was raised on all the heroes of the Boston Marathon. And one day I said to him, I said, well, let's just quit talking about it and run it. And he said, oh, a woman can't run the Boston Marathon. And I said, what do you mean? We're running 10 miles a night in a snowstorm. And he said, well, that doesn't mean that you can run 26 miles. And we argued, and I said, you know, that women throughout history had run the marathon, not many, a half a dozen, and that even Roberta Gibb had run the Boston Marathon in 1966. He just exploded. He said, no dame ever ran the Boston Marathon. But he said, if any woman could do it, I think you could do it. And if you'd prove to me in practice, show me that you could do the distance, I'd even be the first person to take you to Boston.
Tell me about race day.
I was bundled up in a gray sweatsuit, so I looked like one of the guys. But, of course, all the men knew I was a woman, and the officials pushed us into the starting area, and the gun went off, and down the street we went. And 2 miles into the race, the press truck came by, and we were taking pictures and going crazy, seeing a woman in the race wearing numbers. And off the bus, all of a sudden, came Jock Semple in a fury. A woman is in his race, and she's wearing numbers. He clearly thought I was a clown. He thought I was somebody who was making a sacrilege of his wonderful race. He didn't know I had trained. He didn't know I was serious. He just saw red. Went after me, tackled me, and screamed at me, get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers. Try to rip my numbers off. Arnie, my coach, screamed at him, leave her alone. She's okay. I've trained her. And my boyfriend, who only decided to run the Boston Marathon at the last minute because he just happened to be a 235-pound ex-All-American football player, came flying along, threw a cross-body block into Jock, sent Jock flying through the air, and Jock landed on the side of the road, and my coach said, run like hell. And a couple of miles later, when the bus came by again, there was Jock Semple, still in full fury, screaming at us that we were in big trouble and his Scottish broke, and promptly went up to the finish and had me disqualified, not only from Boston, but expelled from the Amateur Athletic Union for a whole bunch of infractions that included running without a chaperone, if you can imagine that, in 1967. But, you know, you can't run 24 miles and stay mad. I spent the next 24 miles of that race trying to figure out what had infuriated him so much. And I knew that Jock was infuriated because he was an overworked race director who loved this race, and he didn't realize that I loved it too. And he thought I was making a mockery of it, and I was bound and determined to prove to him and the world that I was serious. And I was bound and determined also to create other opportunities for women because I knew that they would be in the race if they had only had the same opportunities that I had. And I knew if I could create events that would welcome them and be non-intimidating, that we could open the doors for women worldwide so that they would have that same sense of self-esteem and accomplishment that I felt.
And you went on to do that with the Avon series and things like that.
I wrote a proposal for Avon Cosmetics, and indeed we took this program on the road to 27 countries for over 1 million women. eventually, and the races led to getting the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. And that took place in 1984. And who could have ever forgotten that moment when Joan Benoit Samuelson came through the Olympic tunnel and into the stadium? They saw that and they said, gosh, women can do anything, which is what we said all along.
You say in your book that you wanted to run Boston because of its history, and you really had no idea that you were going to become part of that history. But after the incident with Jock Semple, you realized you absolutely had to finish this race now, given what had happened.
I had to finish the race, because if I didn't finish it, everybody would say, see, women can't do it, and they're always barging in where they're not welcome. And this was on the eve of the feminist movement, and I had no idea even what feminism was. And suddenly, you know, I was one. And, you know, when I finished the race, I was bound and determined to create other opportunities for women. I often say I started the race as a girl and ended up as a woman.
And 40 years later, you're back in Boston. What does it mean to be back here in this place where you made history?
I haven't missed the Boston Marathon once in the last 40 years. I've been here every single year. On the 40th anniversary, it's extremely special because I'm watching, maybe for the first time, that the fact that women actually are the stars of the race on Monday, and that we've moved in my 40 years, in my lifetime, which I'll tell you has gone like that, we've moved from exclusion to exclusivity. And now with a separate women's start, with the emphasis on women's, with the Olympic trials going to be hosted here in Boston for women, it's just absolutely fantastic to see come true what I'd always hoped and dreamed and believed.
I know you remember what your bib number was that day.
Number 261, I'll never forget. I've still got it in my scrapbook, of course, with actually the corner turned off because Jock actually got just the edge of it and ripped the corner off.
That was Catherine Switzer recalling the 1967 Boston Marathon. She and Jock Semple eventually became friends, and women were finally allowed to officially enter the race in 1972. And in that year, Catherine finished third. Catherine Switzer's book is Marathon Woman. She spoke to Here and Now's marathon man, Alex Ashlock, who has his own experience with this race, and it's bittersweet.
In her book, Catherine Switzer calls it the sag wagon. I call it the loser's bus. Whatever you call it, I was on it 2 years ago when I dropped out of the Boston Marathon. I quit at about 18 miles into the race. That's in Newton, where the course starts to head toward what is known as Heartbreak Hill. A race volunteer climbed onto the bus and asked for my timing chip. That's the chip that registers your time as you pass through various checkpoints along the marathon course. I unlaced my left shoe, took the chip off, tossed it in a battered old bucket. There were about a dozen other chips already there. It was a pathetic sight. My training partner Karen had left me in the dust about 10 miles into the race. This happened in my own town. I live right on the course. She finished. She had a party after to celebrate. I was invited. I hated her. I hated everyone at that party. I even hated people who weren't at the party. Well, my hard feelings about the race have softened 2 years later. I still think about the Boston Marathon every day, though, since I drive on the course to and from work every day. But at least when I go home tonight, I won't be on the loser's bus.
Well, Alex, just remember, you're a winner to us. And not to rub it in, but Karen Miller-Metzen, his friend, she's out running again today. Karen, good luck. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.